gets off his bike and follows her to the trailer. She walks around to the door in back. Unable to get a good angle on the padlock with the screwdriver, she pries the hasp off the wall instead. When she gets the door open, she steps inside. Real Deal pokes his head in as she thumbs her Zippo. Red Dawn, Devil's Gold, Thunder King, Big Mama, Titan. The glow from the lighter reveals floor-to-ceiling shelves filled with boxes of rockets, crackers, and Roman candles. The air is spiced with the tang of black powder, and signs warn, no smoking. Christ almighty, be careful, Real Deal says. Yuma pokes around for a cash box, but comes up empty-handed. Approaching headlights send Real Deal into the trailer, too. He pulls the door shut and hisses at Yuma to douse the flame. They stand silently in the dark, so close together they feel the heat coming off each other. The 1-2 punch of tension and relief when the car passes does something to Yuma. She's suddenly tingling in all the right spots and has an idea of what might calm the whirlwind that's been spinning inside her all night. She grabs Real Deal's hand and puts it on her pussy. Real Deal protests, something about too risky. Shut up, Yuma says, and goes to undoing his belt while he works on hers. They do it standing up, her bent over the counter, him coming from behind. She gets off in only a couple minutes, and he pops right after. Real Deal makes himself presentable and steps outside. The road is empty in both directions. The body shops, retread tire outlets, and used car lots scattered along it, snoozing away. Real Deal adjusts his pecker and smiles to himself. What a trip. He smells something acrid, and Yuma dashes out of the trailer. A fusillade of ear-splitting screeches, whistles, and bangs shatters the quiet, and a ball of fire shoots from the trailer's door and blossoms into a spray of hissing sparks. Yuma, waiting at the edge of the lot, laughs at the terror on Real Deal's face as he runs to join her. Happy bicentennial, she says. The din increases in volume, boom upon boom, screech upon screech, and the geyser of sparks shooting out the door is so intense it resembles the tail of a captured comet. A huge explosion makes the fiends flinch, and part of the trailer rises on a mushroom cloud of green and silver glitter and spins end over end to crash to the ground 20 feet from them. They sprint across the road, hop on their bikes, and speed away. Yuma's calmer now, thanks to either the fuck or the fireworks show. Real Deal would like to be angry with her, but he remembers a few years back when he went on a 3-day binge and she stayed by his side the whole time, somehow getting him out of every bit of trouble he got himself into. Afterward, he asked why. I've got all my chips on you, she said, and that's been their motto ever since. Antonia and Elijah are parked outside a bar that's closing for the night. The drinkers turned out of the tavern stand stunned on the sidewalk like people whose houses have been whirled away by a tornado, but there's not a rover among them. The fiend's next stop is a coffee shop called Helsing's. They intended to step inside briefly to check out the customers, but end up at the counter with menus in front of them. It's time to move on, Antonia says. New Orleans, Elijah says. We'll take it slow, search all the towns we pass through on the way. Think the others will go for that? They know it's silly to keep riding around here night after night when the fuckers who dusted Bob are probably long gone. Bob will kick, but he'll either accept it or be on his own. I take it you wouldn't be sorry to see him go? Antonia lets a shrug be her answer, sips her coffee. They eat raw fish in Japan, she says. It's supposed to be healthy for you. She peruses the menu. And we've got hotcakes. I'm so fucking sick of hotcakes. I met a man who swore by potatoes and vinegar, Elijah says. That's all he ate, and he claimed never to have been sick a day in his life. Claimed, in fact, that he survived the plague in Istanbul. Remember that girl in Seattle, Antonia says. Dutch Charlie had turned her. Dutch Charlie, Elijah says. I haven't thought of him in forever. He had that girl who took arsenic to stay skinny, a drop in her tea every evening. Your memory is a marvel, Elijah says. Antonia appreciates the compliment, but doesn't acknowledge it, being shy that way. She goes back to griping about hotcakes instead. She and Elijah continue to ride the streets after their meal, but with no more success than before. At 3:30, they return to the motel, the first ones back. A red light is blinking on the telephone when they get to their room. Antonia calls the office, and the night man answers. "A Mr. Beaumont called," he says. "Wanted me to tell you it's urgent." Chapter 21. What did Beaumont say it would take to make peace with the fiends? The question from Johanna comes out of nowhere. Jesse had thought she was asleep beside him, thought he was the only one lying awake, mind racing. She's under the sheet, in a t-shirt and panties, and he's on top of it, fully clothed. For the first time, he notices a splash of freckles on her nose, something Claudine didn't have. He likes them. "Would you bring them another baby to replace the one you stole?" Beaumont asked him. "I would," Jesse replied. "I'd bring them too." "Would you give up the girl to them?" "No. Your brother." "He thinks they might settle for money," Jesse says to Johanna. "How much money?" "He didn't know. However much it is, though, I'll get it." "How? Not picking pockets. Didn't you tell me you wanted to go out with a bank robber?" Edgar turns on the television. So he's awake, too. He flips through the channels until he finds a cartoon. It's only 2 p.m., a long time until sundown. Johanna's stomach growls. Jesse puts his ear to it. "You got a bear in there?" he says. "A hungry one," Johanna replies. "There's peanut butter, bread, some of that deviled ham. You want me to make you a sandwich?" "I only like peanut butter with milk."
"Me too," Edgar says. "Only with milk."
"Since when?" Jesse says. "I'll go out and get some," Johanna says. She picks up her jeans from the floor and pulls them on under the sheet. Jesse feels a pinch of worry as she slips out the door. It's daytime, and only Beaumont knows they're here, but he'd still rather she didn't wander. He sits at the table and makes the sandwiches.
"I'm feeling lucky," Edgar says. "I bet I hit a super damn jackpot soon."
"Okay, big time," Jesse says. "What'll you do with your winnings?"
"Get me a sweetheart, too."
"Johanna's not my sweetheart. She's just traveling with us for a while. We're looking out for her."
"You're a liar. I saw you kissing her. You was probably feeling on her titties and her cunny, too."
"What would Mama think if she heard you talking like that?"
"Mama's dead," Edgar says. "She can't hear nothing."
Jesse is surprised by this. Edgar normally backs right down when their mother is invoked. Jesse fears he's given him too much rein lately. The best way to keep him safe has always been to keep him cowed. Johanna returns, and the three of them watch Bugs Bunny while they eat. Edgar fills Johanna in on the local kids' shows.
"This here's Channel 8," he says. "They used to have Commander Lee and Bostwick's Western Corral, then they had Miss Cinderella."
The telephone rings. Edgar jumps up and says, "I'll answer," but Jesse grabs the receiver before he can get to it.
"I'm still trying to make contact with the fiends," Beaumont says. "They're a difficult bunch to track down."
"Thanks again," Jesse says. "Let me know as soon as you hear anything."
"Of course," Beaumont says. "In the meantime, I'd like to invite you to dinner. You and Edgar and Johanna."
"You don't have to do that."
"It's been 20 years since we last got together. That's too long for old friends like us. We have catching up to do."
Jesse is in no mood to socialize, but wants to make sure he stays in Beaumont's good graces.
"As long as you don't go to any trouble," he says. "Splendid," Beaumont says. "I'll be looking forward to it. I haven't entertained in ages. I'll expect you tomorrow at midnight. Take down the address."
Edgar is thrilled by the invitation.
"You still got that piano that plays itself?" he asks, recalling a visit they made to Beaumont when he was living in New Orleans. "You still got that parrot?"
That night, at Johanna's insistence, they take in a magic show at the Desert Inn. It's a big production. Showgirls high kick across the stage, a tiger appears out of thin air, and Buddy Hackett stops by to help out on a card trick. Jesse's having a fine time until the magician brings out a rope and ties his assistant to a post, telling a story about how they used to burn witches at the stake. Witch. That's what the men in Hot Springs called Claudine. The magician douses his assistant with liquid from a gas can, strikes a match, and tosses it at the girl's feet. Flames shoot up around her, and Jesse's suddenly back in that Arkansas clearing, coming to in agony but healing quickly after being shot to pieces by the friends of the drunk Claudine fed on. The men are standing over the drunk.
"Poor Jim. Gone, is he?"
"Gone." Jesse plays dead as the men approach him and Claudine.
"Who are these two?"
"The bitch was drinking Jim's blood."
"Some kind of witch, then.
and him the devil that rides with her. One of the men brings a lantern close to Claudine.
Would you look at that, he says.
Claudine's bones are knitting, her flesh mending.
She's putting herself back together, the man with the lantern says.
We gotta burn them, another says. We gotta burn the both of them.
He runs down the trail to a shack. Jesse tries to roll over, but is still too busted up. One of the men sees him struggling and slams the butt of his shotgun into his head, dazing him. The man who went to the cabin returns with a 5-gallon can of kerosene. He soaks Claudine and Jesse with the fuel, and they howl as it seeps into their wounds. The man tries to strike a match, but fumbles.
Stop! Jesse shouts. Stop!
Another of the men pulls a match and sparks it. He drops it on Claudine, and she's immediately enveloped, screaming and writhing in a cocoon of fire. The trees pulse red. Smoke bubbles into the sky. The men turn to Jesse, but before they can light him up too, Claudine springs to her feet and lurches at them, a wailing human torch. One of them runs, but another lifts his shotgun and pulls the trigger. The blast knocks Claudine back to the ground, where she lies burning, silent and still again. Jesse realizes he can move his legs, and marshaling every ounce of his strength, he staggers to his feet and sprints for the dark woods. A shotgun booms, and buckshot burrows into his back, but desperation keeps him going. He plunges into a thicket. Nettles lash at him. Thorns threaten to hang him up. The men pause at the edge of the tangle to argue about who's going after him. He thrashes on until the ground disappears from beneath his feet, and he plummets through darkness to land in a cold, black river. An electric shock shoots through him when he hits bottom. His legs are broken, both of them. The current takes hold of him and whisks him off. He managed to get to shore, managed to find a riverbank cave to shelter in for the day. As soon as the sun set, he returned to the clearing. All that was left of Claudine was a mound of ashes and a patch of scorched grass. He heard a noise on the trail leading to the men's shack, and fled, an act of cowardice he's regretted ever since. It would have been better to have been dusted while trying to get revenge that night than to plod on as he has all the years since under 10 tons of guilt and grief. He held his life cheap afterward, came close to dying many times. Tried to, in fact. It wasn't until he started looking after Edgar in the wake of their mother's death that he finally turned away from the grave. The flames die down, and the audience gasps. The girl has vanished. The magician feigns confusion. Knocking comes from inside a wooden crate on the stage. The magician prances over and opens it, and the girl steps out unscathed. They go for ice cream after the show, and Jesse lets Edgar play another slot machine. He feeds it a roll of quarters without getting anything back, and insists the machine is broken, tries to reach inside it through the tray. Back at the motel, Jesse gets him interested in a Frankenstein movie on TV, so he and Johanna can sit by themselves on the walkway in front of the room. A couple of kids are splashing in the pool. Johanna lights a cigarette and picks up the ashtray.
"Is it stealing to take this with you?" she asks.
"They must mean for you to," Jesse says, "with the name of the place and the telephone number and everything on it."
"The Holiday Motel," Johanna reads off the ashtray.
"Will your folks be worried about you?" Jesse says.
"They live in Santa Fe. They won't even know I'm gone until you make me leave and I call them for the money to get to California."
"You should be glad to be moving on."
"Will you be glad to get rid of me?"
"No," he wants to say, but doesn't.
"You wouldn't want to live the life me and Edgar have, believe me." "Maybe me being around would make things easier for you," she says. "I could run errands during the day, keep you company at night, help with Edgar."
More and more it's her Jesse sees when he looks at her, not Claudine. More and more it's her that makes him smile, not memories. But it's cruel to even flirt with the notion of keeping her with him.
"What are you going to do when she finds out the truth?" he thinks.
"The first time I bring a girl back and cut her throat so Edgar'll stop moaning about his little devil.
Or maybe you're thinking you'd like me to turn you, make you into a monster too."
"As soon as Beaumont sounds out the fiends and sees where they stand, you'll be on your way," he says. "Even if this mess gets settled, you're going. That's the way it has to be."
Johanna takes a puff off her cigarette and watches the kids in the pool.
"You're the boss," she says.
He heads out again to go dipping. Johanna's right. He'll never pull together enough money to pay off the fiends by lifting wallets, but he's got to start somewhere.
and he wasn't joking about robbing banks. He's considered it before, but always felt it was too risky. Now, if that's what it takes to save Johanna and Edgar, he'll rob 10 of them. It's something else to talk to Beaumont about. He can only hope that any heists he plans go as well as dipping does. He hits 2 casinos, and people are practically handing him their wallets. He scores $1,000 in only 3 hours. He returns to the motel at dawn. Edgar's out cold, but Johanna sits up when he comes in. They eat Pop-Tarts, and he tells her about his luck. They fall asleep, lying side by side, but he comes awake later to find her on top of him. She presses her body against his and kisses him deeply. They undress without a word, and before he can stop himself, he's inside her. It's been a long time. There were a few animalistic couplings in the years between Claudine's death and him taking charge of Edgar, but they left him so soul-sick and regretful he hasn't been tempted since. This time, with Johanna, it's like a balm, a soothing salve that makes him think his sorrow might not be permanent after all. Afterward, they're both on their backs, looking at the ceiling. Sunlight beams through a hole in the blackout curtain, and music's playing somewhere.
"Thank you for that," Jesse says.
"I shouldn't have done it," Johanna says. "I wasn't thinking."
"It was a gift," Jesse says.
Johanna rolls away from him.
"Stop," she says. "Please."
Whatever it takes to save her. Whatever it takes. He rolls over in the other direction, toward Edgar's bed, and his brother's eyes are wide open, glaring at him. He lets Edgar mess around in the pool for half an hour after the sun goes down. He's tried 100 times to teach him to swim, but Edgar can't move his arms and legs in unison and won't put his face underwater. His idea of fun is walking out into the deep end until only his head's showing, then bouncing back to the shallow end.
"Bring me my cars," he calls to Jesse. "I'm going to wash them."
"Time to go," Jesse says. He stands and stretches while Edgar lollygags to the ladder. Something sharp digs into his heel. He dislodges a sliver of glass embedded there with his fingernail and wipes away the drop of blood that wells before the puncture closes. Johanna is in a good mood as they get ready to go to supper at Beaumont's. Jesse's happy to see it. She turns on the radio and dances while brushing her hair. Twirling in the green dress Jesse bought her, she asks,
"Is this fancy enough for Monsieur Beaumont?"
hamming a French accent.
"Fancy enough for anyone if you're wearing it," Jesse says.
Edgar's locked in the bathroom. Jesse knocks on the door.
"Hold your horses.
Let me in." The door opens, and Edgar's standing there with Jesse's razor in his hand and a big grin on his face.
"What the hell did you do?" Jesse says. "Shaved myself," Edgar says. "What do you think?"
Jesse's been shaving his brother as long as he's been looking after him. Edgar afraid to do it himself after trying and winding up nicked from cheek to chin. He got himself in a couple spots this time, too, but that didn't stop him. Jesse takes hold of his jaw and twists his head from side to side.
"Smooth as a china teacup," he says.
Emboldened by this success, Edgar demands to drive to Beaumont's when they go out to the Grand Prix and gets pissy when Jesse refuses. Johanna distracts him with a game.
"I spy with my little eye something yellow," she says.
"Is it a banana?"
"Man, where's there a banana around here?" Beaumont lives beyond the edge of the city. His house, which resembles a concrete bunker fortified against the hot sun and scouring winds of the desert, is perched on a rise with a view of the strip, the yard landscaped with cacti and boulders lit from below. Jesse parks on the driveway next to a white Cadillac. Beaumont answers the door dressed in a bright red disco suit. He shakes Jesse and Edgar's hands, kisses Johanna's.
"You look lovely," he says.
The furnishings of the house are modern, chrome and black leather, the carpet spotless white shag. Nothing, not the abstract paintings on the walls, the enormous television, the hi-fi system, hints that the man living here is 2,000 years old. Beaumont leads them into the sunken living room, where they share a long couch while Beaumont relaxes in a swivel chair on the other side of the glass coffee table.
"Champagne, Tommy," he says,
and a young man dressed in old-time livery brings in a tray with 4 glasses on it.
"This place is something," Jesse says. "I designed it myself," Beaumont replies.
Jesse once asked Claudine where the man got his money.
"He married well," she said, "many times."
"You don't got that parrot anymore," Edgar says.
Gigi, Beaumont says. The one could speak French. The man in the servant get-up returns, this time offering shrimp and little meatballs on toothpicks.
Gigi passed away some time ago at the ripe old age of 80, Beaumont says. I was devastated.
Edgar licks a meatball and pops it into his mouth. You should get you another, he says. Teach it to talk Chinese.
I'm afraid I don't speak Chinese, Beaumont says.
I do, Edgar says. Ching chong, ching chong, ching chong.
I have something you'll like even more than Gigi, Beaumont says.
He takes Edgar over to the hi-fi and hands him a microphone.
Sing something.
Edgar belts out, Take Me Home, Country Roads, and Beaumont flips a switch when he finishes, playing back a recording of the performance. Edgar is thrilled.
I could be on the radio, he says. After dinner you can do another, an old one for me, Beaumont says.
Sliding glass doors in nearly every room of the house open onto an interior courtyard. Dinner is served there at a table set with a white cloth, black plates, and candelabras that look like silver snakes strangling one another. Tommy pours wine. The soup has lobster in it.
So fancy, Johanna says. I don't have many guests, so when I do, I go all out, says Beaumont.
You live here by yourself?
Tommy stays in the guest quarters and runs the house, but it's still a lonely life. In fact, your visit, Johanna, is the most exciting thing to happen to me in a long time.
Johanna blushes and says, I doubt that.
You're from Phoenix. How do you find it there?
It's fine, but I'm on my way to L.A. now.
Los Angeles is a wonderful city. I lived in Hollywood for a time. Are you hoping to get into the movies?
Now you're being funny.
You're certainly pretty enough, Beaumont says. Isn't she, Jessie?
Sure, Jessie says.
I always told Claudine that under different circumstances she could have been a star on the stage, and you're as beautiful as she was.
She sounds like she was a special person, Johanna says. Jessie speaks highly of her.
He hardly knew her,
Beaumont says, the sudden scorn in his voice making Jessie uneasy.
She and I traveled together for 20 years. The best 20 years of my life. She was a jewel. A rare jewel, too valuable to be entrusted to the likes of Jessie. He was much too stupid to appreciate her.
I told you what happened, Jessie says. There was nothing I could do.
I grieve her still, Beaumont says to Johanna. But now look, you've come along. And though you're not the original, there is value in an almost perfect copy.
The doors surrounding the patio all slide open at once, and big men and hard women in leather and denim step through them. The fiends. Jessie stands on the verge of panic. The rover he fought, the one who jumped off the cliff, slips behind Johanna and lays a knife to her throat.
Down, motherfucker, he says to Jessie.
Jessie collapses more than sits, legs gone numb, and a short-haired blonde woman puts a gun to his head. There are 7 fiends in total, guarding him, guarding Edgar. They check them for weapons, running their hands over their chests, around their waists, up and down their legs.
Jessie, Johanna says, eyes wide with fear. It'll be okay, Jessie says.
He turns to Beaumont.
You set me up?
I've put things right, Beaumont says.
I thought of taking revenge for Claudine every time I've seen you since her death. But either my courage wavered or the circumstances were against it. I've lived long enough, however, to understand the power of patience, and I knew an opportunity to punish you for your carelessness would eventually present itself. When you called the other day, everything finally fell into place.
The ancient rover sips his wine and gestures with the glass at Johanna.
The girl was something I hadn't anticipated, but something that pleases me greatly, he continues. Partial compensation for my years of mourning, Claudine.
He stands and holds out his hand.
Come with me now and you'll not be harmed, he says to Johanna. You'll live a life beyond your wildest dreams.
I, Johanna stammers.
Go with him, Jessie says.
What's your hurry, Beaumont? The short, burly fiend holding the knife to Johanna's throat says.
We agreed. Sit down.
Beaumont sinks into his chair. Jessie addresses the fiends, though he knows it's futile.
I can get money, he says. I can get another baby. Whatever you want me to do to make up for what happened, I'll do it.
The fiend holding the knife on Johona says,
"Money's not going to even things up. Neither is another baby."
"Fine," Jesse says, "but let my brother and the girl go. He's a half-wit, and she's stumbled into this." The fiend with the knife walks over to Edgar and bends to peer into his face.
"Is that true?" he says. "Are you a half-wit?"
Edgar starts to cry. Chapter 22.
I got a sack of saltwater taffy from Virginia Beach. I got a Mickey Mouse shirt and a Superman shirt. I got a Sunday school medal for memorizing verses. And when I passed by thee and saw thee polluted in thine own blood, I said unto thee, when thou wast in thy blood, live. Yea, I said unto thee, when thou wast in thy blood, live.
I knew what Jesse and Johona were up to under the covers at the motel. He had his pecker in her. And all the while the little devil hissed how I should do something about her. He didn't believe she'd be shoving off soon. He said her and Jesse was gulling me. In the swimming pool I played, I was a giant in the ocean. I scooped up a drowned moth. They're the same as butterflies, but come at night. Their wings are made of powder, and if you touch them, turn to dust. I shaved myself. There's an extra 2 bits in it for you if you don't draw blood. Down on the cheeks, up on the neck, easy does it, under the nose. Monsieur Beaumont lived in a big white house in New Orleans. Now he lives in the desert. Jesse made me comb my hair before he knocked on the door. We sat down to supper. The soldier brought wine and I did a toast. Here's to Monsieur Beaumont, here's to Miss Johona, here's to Mr. Jesse, and here's to me. The fiend from the mountain put his face in front of mine and the way he looked made me cry. Hold him, he said, and he went to sawing at my ear with his knife. Leave him be, Jesse yelled, but that didn't stop him. Wasn't nobody gonna do me like that, though. I stood and shrugged off the bastards holding me down. They went to stabbing me, but I kept swinging. Jesse broke away, too, and we give him a fight until the fiend from the mountain yelled, Hey! He was behind Johona again, using her hair to pull her head back, had his knife at her throat again. His men shoved me into my chair and Jesse into his. I was cut so bad I couldn't breathe. The fiend from the mountain said, My partner's name was Bob, and he was worth 10 of this cunt. Stop, Beaumont yelled. But the fiend ignored him and cut Johona's throat just like that. Her heart pumped her blood through the gash beat by beat, and it sprayed across the tablecloth. She tried to pull in air but couldn't, and her face got the same scared look they all get when they know they're dying. Don't fight it, Jesse yelled. Let go. She blinked like someone trying to stay awake. She started to shiver. Then she was gone. Mama's making biscuits. Flour, bacon powder, bacon soda, salt, lard, milk. She folds the dough and presses it flat and lets me cut circles with an empty soup can. You gotta press straight down without twisting and gotta be careful when you take them out of the oven. If you drop one, you'll have uninvited company. When the flow was down to a trickle, the fiend stuck his finger in the cut, showed the blood to Jesse, then licked it off. He let Johona's head drop and come at me again. Now you, big boy, he said, let's see what you look like without a nose. I yanked a hand free and grabbed him by the throat. Something cracked and he went to gagging. The others swarmed me like wild dogs, punching, kicking, stabbing. For every one I slung off, 2 more jumped on. Jesse was up again, too. He slammed a blonde girl's head into the table, took her gun, and shot a man. Monsieur Beaumont was against a wall, looking like he was going to be sick. It was all his doing, and I meant to kill him, but was having trouble walking. Someone stabbed me in the back. The blade was cold as an icicle going in, hot as a freshly forged spike coming out. A redhead raised a pistol and shot me in the chest. I fell fast down into the dark. The little devil laughs and shows his teeth. I'm dead, I tell him. Leave me be. I ain't done with you yet, he says. Popeye eats spinach to get strong. Sinbad the sailor cinches his belt. Underdog's got him a pill. I chew a red M&M and lift a chair over my head till Jesse makes me stop. Where you at, Jesse? I ain't mad at you no more. Come get me. Come bring a light and I promise to toe the line.
Chapter 23. June 30th, 1976, Las Vegas. Continued. You want me to kill you? I said, not sure I'd heard Sally right. If you won't let me go, yeah, he said. I'll take you to Beaumont. You catch him and lock him in your box and dust me. I was standing in a heartless motel room in the heartless city, clutching a dead man's pistol and listening to a monster trying to convince me to end his life. The grotesqueness of the situation stalled me for a second. "What do you say?" Sally asked. There was no way I could give him an answer right then, so I marched him out to the camper and locked him in the crate. Back in the room, the television blared. I turned off the set, but the silence was even worse. I put on a clean shirt and walked the two blocks to the strip. A band was playing your favorite song, Misty, in the lounge of the first casino I came to. It was Pearls Before Swine. Three white girls in bouffants and mini dresses cackled over Mai Tais. A table of cowboys talked baseball at the top of their lungs, and the bartender's corny jokes drowned out the singer. A man sitting at the corner of the bar struck me as strange as I sipped my beer. His blonde hair was neatly combed and parted, and he wore a nice sports shirt and pressed slacks. But there was something mocking, something sinister about his smile. He turned his colorless gaze my way and lifted a long, thin cigarette to his two red lips. A rover, I thought. He got up quickly and left the bar. And I wondered if, in the same way they recognized each other, the monsters are able to sniff out someone who's killed their kind. Was there something in the blood of the woman and child from last night that clung to me and marked me as a hunter? Or was the man just another tourist and my imagination running wild? I worry that part of my fate is to live life choked by that kind of fear and paranoia. I imagine it's how Adam felt after eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge, when all the evil he'd been ignorant of was suddenly revealed. Did he, like me, mourn his loss of innocence? Did he, like me, question whether the knowledge was worth it? Today's passage. Have pity upon me. Have pity upon me, O ye my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. Job chapter 19, verse 21. July 1st, 1976, Las Vegas. I felt better this morning after last night's hysterics. Sleep had recharged my batteries, and I spent an hour with a good book to fortify my soul. I decided this Beaumont, this rover royalty, was someone I should look into. So when the sun went down, I brought Sally in and asked where I could find him. He lives here in Vegas, Sally said. At least he did 15 years ago, when I last saw him. I remember where his house is. We can drive out there right now. I didn't have a better idea, so I walked him to the truck, locked him to the bolt in the cab, and we were on our way. His directions took us out of the city and into the desert, to a neighborhood where the houses were widely spaced and set far off the road. We meandered for an hour, making U-turn after U-turn and driving the same streets again and again. When we came to our 10th dead end, asphalt giving way to sand and tumbleweeds, I'd had enough. You don't have any idea where you're going, do you? I said. We're close. I feel it, Sally said. And I feel like you're wasting my gas and my time. Whip around and go back to that last intersection. We came to a street sign we'd missed before, for Red Rock Road. I turned there, and Sally rolled down his window and stuck out his head to see better. We'd gone half a mile, passing five or six driveways, when he pointed to a house. What makes you sure? I said. They all look alike in the dark. I told you, man, I remember. I parked far enough up the road that someone turning into the home's drive wouldn't notice the truck. After unlocking Sally, I grabbed a pair of binoculars out of the glove box, and we walked a short distance into the desert, the kids' chains rattling with each step, then turned toward the house. We eventually topped a low-rise capped by a stunted tree, a lucky bit of cover. Crouched there, we had a clear view of the driveway and front door 50 yards away. The house was a concrete box built around a patio and had a guest cottage out back. The few windows were small and set high on the walls. There was no car in the drive, and the only lights were colored spots scattered around the yard. "Looks like nobody's home," I said. "Or maybe he's gone to bed." "Before daybreak?" Sally said. "Not Beaumont." "Let's get closer," I said. We ended up walking all the way down to the house and circling it. A door in back had a window in it. I looked through it into a storage room that opened onto the dark kitchen. Beyond that was the patio on the other side of a sliding glass door. There were no signs of life. We returned to the rise, and I told Sally I was going to wait another hour, see if anybody showed. "Fine with me," Sally said. "I'm enjoying the fresh air." He sprawled on the sand. The night was warm and windless, and the stars outshined the strip in the distance. Sally pointed out airplanes passing overhead and traced the paths of satellites. A coyote yipped, another chimed in, and soon a chorus howled. Sally peered into the darkness. "You got that gun?" he said, making me uneasy, too. He talked about his childhood. I wasn't interested. Only half listened while watching the house. "My old man got it into his head he was going to raise rabbits for extra money," he said. "Since it was summer and school was out, taking care of them was my responsibility. I didn't want the job, but that didn't matter. The old man's word was law." It was three does and a buck. There wasn't much to looking after them besides feeding and watering. Those rabbits had it better than we did. When it got hot, I soaked burlap sacks and spread them over the hutches to cool them while we suffered with a swamp cooler. I was only 10 years old, but already knew I couldn't live like that. I dropped to my belly when a car came down the road and hissed for Sally to do the same. The white Cadillac turned into the driveway of the house. The garage door rose and a light went on. While the driver, a white boy, waited to pull into the garage, a tall, bald black man got out of the back seat and walked to the front door of the house. He had those scars on his forehead, the kind you sometimes see on African brothers. I passed the binoculars to Sally. "That's him," he said. Beaumont went inside, and the garage door clanked down behind the car. I'd learned enough for one night, didn't want to push my luck. Sally and I crept to the truck and came back to the motel. He kept at me the whole way, asking when I was going to make my move on Beaumont. I told him I hadn't worked out yet whether making a move was worth my while. It wasn't what he wanted to hear, and I had to lock him in the box so I could get some peace. That was an hour ago. I'm going to hit my knees here before I go to sleep and ask God for guidance, and hopefully my prayers won't be snatched out of the air by any devils working to defeat me. Today's passage. To expect the worst is to set yourself up for failure. Prepare for the worst. Expectation is passive. Preparation is active. Always be active. Listen, respond, win. A New Path to Success by Dr. Christine Pellegrino. July 2nd, 1976, Las Vegas. I got no direction last night. No revelations or commandments. Whether or not I was going after Beaumont, though, my arsenal needed beefing up. So after a banana and a cup of instant coffee, I went to a sporting goods store and bought a 12-gauge shotgun and shells, more rounds, an extra magazine, and a shoulder holster for the .45, and a hunting knife with an ankle sheath. Back at the motel, I loaded the magazines and put one in the .45. The holster was invisible under my jacket, and after a little practice, my draw was pretty smooth. I'll never again be overwhelmed like I was by the woman and child. Whenever I hunt from now on, I'll be armed to the teeth and loaded for bear. I brought Sally in at sundown and fed him some Kentucky Fried Chicken. The Dodgers were playing the Padres, and I let him watch the game. By the time it was over, I'd resolved to drive out to Beaumont's again. I lock Sally in the crate for this trip, tired of his constant jabber and wanting to see if I could find my own way. I remembered the route fairly well, made only a couple of wrong turns. Parking in the same spot as last night, I walked up the rise alone. This evening there were lights on in the house, and music played faintly, something classical. I started thinking I should go in after Beaumont right then. The .45 was under my arm, the knife strapped to my leg, and Czarnecki's bag in the camper had everything else I'd need. I talked myself out of the notion pretty quickly. I didn't know the layout of the house and wouldn't have the advantage of daylight. And what if someone else was with him? I watched a while longer, but learned nothing new. I won't say the trip was a waste of time, but I don't feel the need for any more scouting. If I'm going to do this, I've got to do it. And tomorrow's the day. I'll storm the house at noon, and if I can't capture Beaumont, I'll kill him. Sally will be disappointed if that's how it goes down, but what are a monster's tears to me? July 4th, 1976, Las Vegas. A blunder, a battle, a deal with the devil. I'm taking advantage of a quiet moment to set down what happened over the past 24 hours, and they may well be the last words I ever write. As I'd planned, I parked up the road from Beaumont's house at noon yesterday, guns loaded, knife ready, crowbar in hand. I left Sally chained inside the crate and snuck to the top of the rise. Lying beside the little tree, I scanned the house through the binoculars. The drapes were drawn, but I was sure Beaumont was inside. I said a prayer to steel myself. Dear Lord, you are my refuge and fortress. You are my sword and my shield. Fill me with bravery and strength as I prepare to confront evil. Then, nothing. I lay on my belly in the dirt. The fire I'd been stoking all morning had gone out. 5 minutes passed, 10, as I tried to will my body to stand and approach the house. I pleaded with myself, reasoned with myself, slapped my face until my cheek throbbed, but it was no use. All the way back to the motel, I invented fresh excuses. I needed more time to think the plan through. I hadn't slept well the night before. My back was giving me trouble. The truth is, I'd simply lost my nerve. Beaumont wasn't drunk like the Mexican in Reno. He wasn't a woman or a child. According to Sally, he was a powerful figure, king of the Rovers. And contemplating that had unstrung me. Nervous energy and dumb luck had gotten me through my first encounters with the monsters, but that wouldn't be enough in the long run. I spent the rest of the day questioning whether I was cut out to follow in Czarnecki's footsteps. It seemed I lacked the courage to confront evil face to face and the savagery to dispatch it with no qualms. And without iron resolve and a killer's cold heart, I was doomed. By nightfall, I was exhausted. It was a relief to bring Sally in for dinner and listen to his story about a thief who got caught because he couldn't stay away from his favorite Times Square dive. He asked for a beer. I said no, but made him a second ham sandwich. It was right about then I decided I'd rather spend the night watching Beaumont's house than torturing myself in the room. Maybe this would be the time I discovered some weakness that'd give me an advantage. I drove out and parked by the side of the road. Sally begged to join me when I went back to the camper for the .45, said four eyes would be better than two. I gave in and let him out of the crate, hoping his chatter would drown out the bickering in my head. The first thing I noticed when we got onto the rise was a second car in the driveway, a Grand Prix. Then the sound of someone singing inside the house reached my ears, followed by laughter and applause. It got quiet after that. My eyes were pressed to the binoculars, but there was nothing to see. I was considering sneaking down to peek through the window in the back door when Sally moaned. "What is it?" I said. "The cuffs are pinching," he replied. I crouched beside him. "Show me." I caught a glimpse of the rock in his hand right before he slammed it into my head. The first blow stunned me. The next laid me out. I came to in a world of pain. My brain wobbled when I sat up, and I had to wipe blood out of my eyes. I don't know how long I was down, but Sally had almost reached the house, going as fast as he could in his shackles. I drew the .45 and set off after him. A commotion, yelling and gunshots erupted inside the house. This didn't slow Sally. He pounded on the front door, shouting for Beaumont and saying, "It's Sally Spiotto! I need help!" I didn't slow down either. Mad as hell, I crossed the driveway as Beaumont ran out the door. He pushed past Sally, but pulled up short when he saw me. Without thinking, I shot him in the chest, and he dropped to the ground. Sally dashed inside and tried to close the door on me. I put my shoulder to it, forced it open, and stepped into a slaughterhouse. Blood everywhere. Sally ran off, but my way was blocked by a body on the floor, and a black biker with a short natural and a goatee bent over it with a knife. A red-headed white girl pointed a pistol at me. My hands are shaking now, recalling the scene. But in that instant, I fired the .45 with no hesitation and got her in the head. Then the brother charged, and I shot him too. Another biker, a big Mexican, ran at me out of the shadows, and I fired once more, hitting him in the arm. He dropped the knife he was carrying but kept coming. I lost the .45 when he tackled me. He hooked his good arm around my neck, but I grabbed his hair, shifted my weight, and was able to flip him so we were both lying on our backs, me on top. I hammered him with my elbows, then grabbed for the knife sheathed on my leg. He got hold of it before I did and slipped out from under me. Sitting on my chest, he punched me in the face again and again and raised the blade. Before he could finish me off, a gunshot sounded and a geyser of blood spouted from his forehead. He fell on me, dead weight. And when I pushed him off, I found myself looking down the barrel of a pistol held by a young white man, maybe 22, 23, with dark hair and eyes. "Who are you?" he said. "I came for Beaumont," I told him. "Where is he?" "Out front. I shot him." "If you want to get out of here alive, we have to work together," the kid said. "I want to get out of here alive," I said. The young man, Jesse is his name, I know now, picked up my knife and said, "Stick this in Beaumont's heart and bring him inside." Still rattled by the fact that I'd just killed two people and dazed by the beating I'd taken, I was happy someone else had a plan. Happy to do as I was told. I grabbed the .45, too, and walked to the front door. Beaumont was already trying to crawl away. "Wait," he said, raising his hand. I kicked him onto his back and jammed the knife into his chest. Leaving the blade inside him, I dragged him into the house. Jesse was kneeling next to the man I'd almost tripped over when I came in the first time. He helped him, his brother, Edgar, sit up, saying, "Take it easy. You'll be good as new soon enough." The redhead I shot groaned, coming back to life. Jesse found a knife on the floor and stabbed her with it, then hacked at her neck until her head came off and she turned to ash. "Rovers," I said. "All of them." "You didn't know?" Jesse said. My relief, I'd killed monsters, not humans, was short-lived. I knew I was still in danger. "We've got to dust them," Jesse said. "You take care of these two." He gestured at the bikers on the floor, the Mexican and the black one, "and I'll do the ones on the patio." I picked up the knife the Mexican had dropped and went to work on him. The wound in his forehead was already smaller than it had been moments before. He opened his eyes and screamed a silent scream, but I kept cutting until he crumbled. I was about to do the same to the brother when a glass door shattered, and Jesse backpedaled into the house, firing his pistol. He ran past me and pulled Edgar behind a couch. I scurried to an open door and found myself in a hallway. A blood-spattered blonde and a limping biker came in from the patio, headed for a door on the other side of the living room. A third biker, a short white man, followed, waving a pistol. Any of you still walking? We're getting out of here, the blonde shouted. Jesse popped up from behind the couch and squeezed off a shot. The short biker fired back. All of a sudden, the black one got to his feet and staggered toward the others. I fired at him and missed, but Jesse put a round in his leg. He kept going, the short biker helping him along while pinning Jesse and me down with random shots. The gang scrambled through the door and slammed it shut. Over the ringing in my ears, I heard motorcycles start up. Jesse ran outside as three Harleys exploded out of the garage and fired after them until his gun was empty. When the sound of the engines had faded, he came back into the house and went to his brother, who was cowering next to the couch. I found Sally hiding in a closet in one of the bedrooms. He didn't struggle when I hauled him out and threw him on the bed. I had to try, he said. I guess, I replied. I slipped the biker's knife between his ribs. He grimaced, moaned, and went limp. I cut off his head, shook his ashes from his shackles, and carried them to the living room. Edgar was lying on the couch. He sat up when I came in. He was a big man, bigger than Jesse, and looked old enough to be his father. He asked me who I was. None of your business, I replied. He's simple, Jesse said. Ignore him. You're Rovers too, I said. I'm the man that saved your life, Jesse said, and this is my brother. He bent and pulled my knife out of Beaumont. I asked what he was up to. He double-crossed me, Jesse said. I want him to see my face before I dust him. I can't let you kill him, I said. Try and stop me. I pointed the .45. I'm taking him with me, I said. What for? To hunt with. Hunt? Rovers. Jesse smirked. And I should let you? He said. You owe me, I said. Your brother'd be dead if I hadn't shot those two when I came in. Jesse thought this over, then dropped my knife. Go on, he said. I told him I'd need help getting the man to my truck. You'll have to haul me up, he said. I took a bullet to the gut, and I'm not quite right yet. He grabbed my arm when I reached out, yanked me off balance, and snatched the .45 out of my hand. Pointing it at me, he stood on his own and said, Any other weapons you've got, drop them too. I don't have anything else, I said, feeling like a fool for letting him get the jump on me. I'll make you a deal, he said. I mean to wipe out the rest of those bastards. I can do it myself, but it'd be quicker and easier with two. Fight with me, and you can have Beaumont once they're dusted. How much help do you think I'd be? I said. It took you all of 2 seconds to get my gun off me. You handle yourself okay up to then. And if I say no, I'll kill you and Beaumont right now. I lost a lot of blood from the cut on my head, and the adrenaline was wearing off. So, truthfully, at that moment, I didn't give a damn about Beaumont. I was only thinking about getting out of that house alive. What do you want me to do? I said. Jesse pointed at Sally's chains. Put those on Beaumont before he comes to. I had him all trussed up by the time he flooded back to life a few minutes later. What's happened here? He said. Not what you planned, Jesse said. You have me wrong. Jesse smacked him in the face with the .45 and ordered me to gag him with a biker's bandana. Then Jesse and I walked up the road to get the truck. I parked in the driveway and we carried Beaumont out to the camper and locked him in the crate. Back in the house, Jesse got a blanket out of one of the bedrooms and took it to the patio. He wrapped up the body of a girl whose throat had been cut and told me and Edgar to take her out. He was holding Zernecki's .45 on me, but his gun hand shook as we laid her in the camper next to the box. Where to? I said when we were all in the cab of the truck. Just drive, he said. I'm going to quit for now, baby. Hopefully get to the rest later. It's 2 p.m. Beaumont's in the camper, and the brothers and I are in my room. Jesse's guarding me from the table with the .45. Edgar's asleep on one of the beds, and I'm on the other, feeling like Daniel in the lion's den. If I die helping this kid go after the bikers, You'll never hear what I'm about to say next. But I want to set it down anyway, say it in my mind, and send it out into the universe. I love you, baby. You've always been better than me, smarter than me, stronger than me. Remember the good times. That's all I ask. Because that's what I'll be doing, seeing your sweet smile as I take my last breath.
Chapter 24. When Antonia returns Beaumont's phone call, she's thinking he has another job for them. People come to him for help, and if it's a problem the fiends can solve, he acts as go-between for 10% of whatever they get for handling it. This call isn't about a hit or a robbery, though. It's about something better. Unaware of Beaumont's connection to the fiends, the rover who dusted Bob asked him to contact them to see if there was some way to make amends. What the fool didn't know is that Beaumont has been harboring his own grudge against him for years, something about a woman they both knew in the past. He's coming to Vegas to meet with Beaumont, and Beaumont suggests the fiends travel to Vegas too, where he and they will settle both their scores at once. Antonia agrees to make the trip, and the gang erupts at the news, cheering and punching and hugging one another. They ride for Vegas the next night with a plan to crash at Bull's Motel on the outskirts of town, a 10-cabin motor court so dilapidated it doesn't even have a sign anymore, just a red neon arrow. Bull isn't a rover, but he's fine with accommodating them as long as there's no killing or feeding on the premises. He'll even run daytime errands for a price. He steps out of his cabin barefoot, shirtless and wearing Bermuda shorts when they ride up, a big, bald, fat man who claims he used to be a mobster in New York. "Do you have room for us?" Antonia says.
"Enough for them," Bull says, "but you'll have to bunk with me."
"Shit," Antonia says. "You can't even see your pecker over that gut." Bull grins around the joint in his mouth.
"That's okay," he says. "You can tell me if it's still there."
"We need 3 cabins. We'll be staying 2, maybe 3 days. There's no registration book. Bull just tosses them their keys. Only one other cabin is occupied by a professor from Germany who's come to the desert to study scorpions.
"I don't know how serious he is," Bull says. "He's usually fucked up on schnapps by noon."
Antonia uses Bull's phone to call Beaumont. He says the rovers they're after, a man named Jesse and his retarded brother, have arrived in town, along with the girl who stole the baby. He's invited them to his house for dinner tomorrow night, and how he's got it figured is that the fiends will show up before they get there and lie in wait for them. His only request in exchange for letting the gang exact their revenge at his place is that he be allowed to keep the girl. Antonia runs this by the other fiends. They're fine with giving him the girl, but Bob pitches a fit at having to delay his vengeance for even a short while. Wants Antonia to call Beaumont back and find out where the rovers are staying. A quaalude and a few beers mellow him out, and soon they're celebrating their good fortune, all of them gathered around a picnic table under a tamarisk tree at the edge of the motel parking lot. Bull's drinking with them, and so's the German. Johnny keeps throwing him the Nazi salute and barking, "Heil Hitler!" And the German keeps saying, "Fuck Hitler!" "Is that jump joint still open, out toward the lake?" Bob asks Bull.
"Last I heard," Bull replies. "What's the name of the girl you like there?" Bob says to Pedro. "Blonde hair, big ass."
"Jenny?"
Pedro says. "Let's pay her a visit."
"I'm in too," Johnny says.
"How about you, Colonel Klink?" Bob says to the German. "You like ze poozy?"
"You will go on the Harley Davidsons," the German says.
"How else?"
"Wonderful."
They ride off a few minutes later. Pedro and Bob on one bike, Johnny and the German on another. Bull goes to bed, and Antonia, Elijah, Real Deal, and Yuma play 5-card stud. They talk about going to New Orleans when this is over, and Elijah tells stories about when he lived there back when Spain still claimed it.
"Just like now,"